It's on when I mash up.
It's on right now. Just let it load. I'm going to, there are several things I'd like to know simply about the institution, if I may. If you have some prepared material, you know, it's dates of founding and names of founders and early localities of the bank and the history of the bank, that would be useful to me. But what you have is available on paper, you know, and the annual statement that you publish, and those things. That'll save conversation, anything of that sort.
We do.
I assume so. The general history. What about this location? How long have you been here?
Well, we've been in this block since 1908.
You started here then, back then.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Not in the same building, but we've been, we were next door.
Yes. I see you have a new an architect's drawing out there, a sketch hanging on the wall. Is that a projected?
This is our new building in Charlotte.
At Charlotte. How many branches do you have?
Three.
Where are the other ones?
There's one here, one in Charlotte, one in Raleigh.
This is the original one, is it?
That's right. This is the home office.
Home office.
Very shortly, we'll have one more in Durham. We received permission to open another.
I also wanted to get, you probably have a lot of this in some sort of form that you give me. Prepared some biographical material. I suppose you have some biographical sketches.
Yes, I do.
I won't trouble you about that then now. Let me push you on to some other topics then, if I may. Or the whole question of business is a field I know nothing about to begin with, but the whole question of Negro businesses, I have read it in the people who write about it, you see, has been a little puzzling to me. That is, by and large, and this is said by a good many sociologists, it seemed to lag behind the development in certain other fields of achievement as compared to Negro writers or Negro artists of various kinds or scholars. By and large, it has not kept at the same level of achievement. Does that seem to you to be true or not?
Yes, it's undoubtedly true, although there have been some significant achievements by Negroes in the field of business.
There have been, yes, indeed, clearly. But go back to an earlier stage, a little earlier stage. How would you account for that lag?
Well, particularly since the turn of the century.
Yes.
Any Negro in business has suffered from the artificial barriers which keep him away from the total market. This is true all over the United States, not just in the South, but probably much more rigidly enforced in the South in terms of residential separation, understandings between real estate boards that there be no, and actually in most of the charters of the real estate boards throughout the country, they cannot sell certain properties to Negroes, and no Negro can be a member. The board, the groups of appraisers, have not until recently begun to admit Negro appraisers, no matter how well qualified. This is in the real estate business.
Yeah.
Location is extremely important. Even now, there are problems down in the heart of New York. If a Negro purchaser, a Negro tenant comes into question, I mean, the minute he comes into the picture, there are barriers even now.
Now, how do you account for the success of this institution in the light of that?
Well, it's been a matter of sheer determination, and also it's a question of having been in the kind of business that met a very urgent need among Negro people. the life insurance, well, there were several life insurance companies that for years refused to write policies on Negroes. And I can think of a very large one in Virginia, which is just now returning to the Negro market. They went out of it about 1908 or 9. One of our largest insurance companies in the whole country, for years, wouldn't write any Negro risks, sick benefit policies, and their life policies were limited to those with the least forfeiture value. In many cases, the rates were higher because the risk was rated as substandard. So this gave the Negro Insurance Company a clear field.
Yes.
In the banking business, there's always been a great need for Negro people to pursue a policy of thrift. And at one time, there were, I'd say, well over 50 institutions in the country that called themselves banks that were operated by Negro people. This, you see the beginnings of this way back during Reconstruction. And then the great movement to get the Congress to authorize the Freedmen's Bank.
Yes, that's the first one, huh?
Well, before that, there were some efforts at loan societies and
yes.
savings groups all over the country that the freedmen established on their own. But they were hoping for a big national institution, which the Freedmen's Bank created an image for. It was... Because you know the story of even the federal, a color of federal protection,
yes.
the bank failed, and
yes,
and Congress refused to restore the savings of the depositors. They these institutions, wherever they have been, have done a great deal to create. A sense of pride in the respective communities, in their respective communities, and those that have survived have created an entirely different market.
In what sense?
Well, if there were limited lending policies for Negro customers in a town, the entrance of an institution, no matter how small, operated by Negroes, it began any kind of lending operation immediately has caused some change on the basis of competition. Sometimes the competition was not very real, but the prospects of it becoming real have changed the policies of many institutions in the South not operated by Negroes. This is true with the insurance companies. I can recall that in the 30s, when there was no market for any FHA loans under Title II to a Negro borrower. And such a market as there was existed in one or two Negro insurance companies. The big insurance companies and big institutional investors in the country would not buy them. Now, many of them are bidding for these. After they found out that the borrowers in this group were regular in their payments, that the incidence of foreclosure was even lower than in the cases of some white groups, now they've been bidding for these within a certain range. This creates a whole new market. It creates a new market among the banks, and it's and what they may want to do in the lending process. This goes for Negro businessmen and their businesses, working capital loans and so forth.
Now, clearly, the real estate restrictions do not apply to your institution, though.
Well, the town grew up around these. Yeah, see, this property here is owned by the North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company. We lease our quarters here from them. But the town was very small when they bought this. And they've just grown with it. Their resources are about $82 million now, the insurance companies are. Our bank's resources are about $15 million. But we've grown with the town.
Yes, yes. Do you think that... This is a hypothetical question, and it may be an inappropriate question. Or at least it may be an inappropriate question that you can put on the record. Or I don't know. Suppose you were coming in, you being such an organization, to buy a location next door down the street. That'd be possible, madam.
I think a great many people would say it would be quite possible, but I'm convinced it wouldn't be as easy to do as it would be if this institution were manned entirely by white persons. And this is in 1964. It would not be nearly so easy. As if the prospective purchaser was a white person or a group of white persons. And this is true now all over the South, still.
I hear it's true in Hall, too.
Yes, it is. You've got it.
Hall is not owned by the inhabitants.
Right.
But tell me this now. How much overlap, business overlap, I don't mean statistically, but I mean between... this bank and White Clientele. How much this integrated business is there at that bank?
Approximately 10% of our dollar volume is from our white customers. Mm-hmm. And we've had them since we opened.
The same percentage or roughly the same people?
About the same percentage. They're not the same people.
Now, of course, they need to die in that time.
But I mean, this indicates, though, that we're able to bring in customers from both races, but not at the same rate.
Well,
but we do reach them across racial lines.
Now, this is in both depositors and in loans.
That's right.
About the same ratio.
That's about right. And this is true in all of our offices in Charlotte and Raleigh, too.
How much expansion, business expansion, is predictable, do you think? Not only in the South, but elsewhere for Negroes. Do you have any tentative views on that?
Well, the means by which you measure this... If you look at the average of the median family income of Negro families throughout the South, compared with the median family income of white families, the Negro families enjoy just about half. And in the last 10 years, each group has gone up, but it's still about half. In some of the bigger cities, the gains of the white population have been greater. Although there have been substantial gains in the Negro population, I think there was a study 2 years ago of incomes of Negro and white families in Atlanta, and the Negro incomes between 50 and 60 rose substantially, but only 2% beyond the rise in the cost of living index. The income of white families rose substantially beyond that.
Yes, that's a general picture of the figures I've seen.
That's right, and this leaves them freer for savings and makes it more difficult to accumulate capital to go into business in the Negro group. They're very close still to the subsistence level. There are many studies that have been made by Southern Negro colleges on the incomes of the families from which their students come. And on paper, you don't see how those students can possibly be in college.
Yes.
They can't be there by any known standards, but they manage.
Several Negro lawyers I've talked to in New Orleans, for instance, have made this observation to me. This is Mr. Augustine there, you may know. Well, in 1951 or 2, they wanted two Negro lawyers in New Orleans. It's a big city. Now they have 25 or 6 as of last spring when I was last there and talked to these lawyers discussing this with me. 25 now. One problem that the lawyers had is he cannot get Negro clients. The problem they have, a very complicated problem. I'm sure you know more about it than most.
Well, as you may know, I'm a lawyer by profession.
I knew that.
And we think that this is in direct proportion to the quality of administration in the courts. As you get into more liberal areas, the Negro lawyer has a much better opportunity. He is not does not have the same difficulty in obtaining clients. You see, the courts can make you or break you if they want to be arbitrary. And we have, I think, 15 lawyers here. 78,000. And there was a time when we had only two. And they dare not try to represent a Negro client against a white person for certain crimes in any outlying community.
You say they won't? Or
they dared not.
Yes,
I can recall when these two lawyers, who were the only ones here some years ago, went over just 40 miles from here to defend a Negro for rape. And they associated with themselves a white lawyer, a very distinguished man of this community. But with the highway patrol and everyone else, they are trying to protect them. They were shot at when they left the courtroom that afternoon. I don't think it was merely to frighten them. They were actually whoever was doing the shooting was trying to shoot them. But that climate has changed a great deal since then. Our own courts in this community and throughout most of North Carolina have recognized the Negro lawyer as a professional. And in many cases, they get their share of appointments to defend persons who are accused of felonies, who are paupers, not able to defend themselves. The court, this is within the discretion of the court. They get their share, not their share maybe, but they get a great many of these cases, which the bench appoints one of them as the attorney for the accused.
How many accused white persons are assigned?
There's been one or two in this community recently. This is a departure. But the rise of the Negro lawyer has been a real hair-raising story of courage and determination to practice his profession in the face of all sorts of threats.
How much have they...
And he's won so much of that battle. He's even won a good bit of it in Mississippi. No, the only two or three. Yes, one doesn't do much practice. The advent of the Negro lawyer began more almost as a movement following World War I, when a number of young fellows who came back to college, could hardly wait. They'd seen France, they'd seen what a free world looked like, and felt how it was to be treated as a free person. And so many of them came back to this country with a commitment to finish college and go to law school. And the movement began then, and so often, as in the case of James Naberg,
yes.
Howard University, almost his first...
I remember the father of the son.
The father. Almost his first activity in the field was his involvement in the first Texas primary case. He went to the Supreme Court of the United States. This was a commitment that they felt they had to fill, and his involvement has continued until now, and as you know, he was very heavily involved in the 54 cases, the Brown case. And the law school at Howard University helped spark the development of the young Negro lawyer.
Yes.
And then you had larger and larger numbers of them entering the field, and there have been law schools. There's a law school here, and then the law school at the University of North Carolina is now open. This has been very helpful. But this is not the business aspect.
No. The law and business have more of a relation than any two other...
Well, I wouldn't think, in a way, but on this particular question... When you're wondering whether someone who goes into a business is going to be able to survive with a limited market, it's a little different from the professional work of a lawyer who depends on the attitude of the courts and his fellow lawyers.
Yes.
For the prestige and standing that will attract clients who think that retaining this particular lawyer will be to their advantage. This is the key, no matter how confident. So often the deciding question is whether or not the lawyer that is retained will be able to handle the case to their satisfaction.
Cut back to business for a moment. It's sometimes said that in certain sectors of Negro enterprise, segregation has meant a protected market, has given a chance that would otherwise perhaps not have been there. The most obvious one they cited being undertaking. That's the most obvious.
Well, I wonder if it's that obvious.
Well, you just said to me, put it this way. Now, you
I wonder. I wonder if it's that obvious. The Negro undertaker, in many instances, years ago, buried white and colored people.
It was a long time back.
Yeah, but if he had this market back.
Yes.
If the coming of integration would give him a free market.
Yes.
Then he would have no complaint. And this, I think this... statement that Negroes who are in business and who are protected by the segregated pattern are the ones who are trying to perpetuate it is a misnomer. For instance, I know two hospitals in a town where the white hospital is very irritated that the Negro hospital doesn't fold up because they need the patients in their clinics. For clinical material for their interns and residents.
Yes.
And they need some of the appropriations they think that this hospital is getting. And they want to integrate the two hospitals and
they want to.
Well, they really what they want to do is take over the Negro hospital. And the question was raised with them, said, well, all right, if we're going to put the two together, the director of the Negro hospital is a graduate of one of the big schools in the country in his field. And he outranks the director of your hospital. If you're going to put these two together, who's going to be the director? So often we neglect to ask those questions. Sure, he's opposed. Sure, he's opposed if you're going to kick him in the street. It's not a question of his wanting to perpetuate segregation. If you're going to put them together, he wants recognition of his rank. Now, this is the question everywhere. The Negro who is in a segregated setup that someone wants to swallow up and sweep out of the way and sweep away all the professional level people and hire a few of the clerks is naturally going to oppose this because there's been no overture to him to come in as an integrated part based on his ability and his experience. And the Negro client of the new institution isn't going to have the protection. They're going to use him and exploit him in every possible way. Now, the white side of this is that they're not being honest. They're trying to, as a smokescreen, they're throwing at our people this charge of our wanting to protect the segregated pattern, but they have no intention of doing any more than taking over some of our institutions and dismissing our best talent.
Now, I would be the first person to agree with it, that exists. I was basing my question on statements by Negroes and not statements by white people analyzing the situation.
Well, many people are misinformed, Negro and white, on this, and they haven't thought about it deeply enough. For instance, we've had one white employee here some years ago, for over a year. He was a man of high competence who came here and worked on the level of an officer. But now, we don't have any white employees now, but neither do my competitors. We took a Negro out of the branch of one of the biggest banks in the country, who was running this branch as the segregated branch of that bank.
A white bank.
Yes. He's a law graduate. He's thoroughly grounded in his college work in accounting and economics. Very fine preparation. He's now had about 20 years of this work, and so he did his first training with us.
Yes.
And then when this bank thought there might be a Negro bank organized in that town, they wanted to know if they could turn that whole branch over to Negro management. And they also wanted to know if we trained some of the people. Well, we did. This was about 12 years ago. And then they took this man to run it. We went to get him back. The president of the bank said to me, he said, well, I thought you'd be asking for him back, and said, I will not object. He said, really, if it was 10 or 15 years further along, he'd have all sorts of opportunities in our organization, because don't have many men that are his equal. He said, but there's nothing to do but let him go back to you, because I can't advance him.
Now, this is in the South and the North.
This is in the South. And you've got a great many Negro clerks in the banks in the North, but almost no officers who have authority.
I know that,
very few who even have junior officer status. But this man could operate a sizable operation and had done it to their great satisfaction. But they were perfectly frank in saying that there was nothing else they could do with him. Although he's part of their organization, they must have 100 branches, and some of them very, very large. And as much as they need talent and manpower, there's nothing they could do with him. If we would emerge today with some large institution in this state, I'm quite sure that they couldn't take out top people and give them the status that they have now. And it's, the only reason is based upon race.
That'll be clear, I guess. No question about that.
So I think this charge is a misnomer, and very interestingly, in the case of these hospitals, some of the people concerned with the white one have become furious about this because they thought they could arrange for the other one to close, and they couldn't work that out on a political basis. And then they threw the charge in a very angry manner. But here was a group of people who were just trying to perpetuate segregation because they had an interest in it.
Now, is this a hospital that receives state funds?
Yeah.
Both hospitals receive state funds.
Mm-hmm.
And they want very badly to integrate their facilities, the big one, so they'd be eligible for some more federal and state funds. But they know full well that if they apply, they're going to have problems because they are segregated. And they figured if they had the Negro hospital out of the way, this would be easier. Be less complaints. They could say, we've got some Negro patients. But they hadn't gotten to the point where they would take any Negro doctors on their staff. And if they took them, they would limit their practice only to the Negro patients.
What are the chances for a Negro medical education in North Carolina?
Now, this is another factor in the medical field. All through the South, we're having trouble getting the bright, young Negro medical students to come back because they don't have the free run of the medical market. They come to a town, in most of the towns, they are not permitted to be on the staff of any hospital. Well, how is a brilliant young doctor going to operate, going to practice without staff privileges? And how is he going to make the most of his knowledge unless he's got the whole market of the town at his disposal?
There's set of figures on the medical side of it that I have looked at, which indicate that the increase in the number of Negro doctors has almost come to a standstill. The overall number has probably been frozen quite a while.
Well,
it's not increasing, not even following the population curve.
Well, one of the problems has been that the very few families who can send their sons.
It's expensive, yes.
And then the scholarship money, although there's plenty of it in the medical field, doesn't drift to the Negro student in the same proportion that it does to the white student. And then there's this other factor that if he expects to practice, well, in many places in the East as well as the South, he's stymied in terms of his ability to keep up with the profession, to be in contact with other doctors and the cooperative arrangement that you find in the hospital where he's been able to stay. No consultations, he just got an office and he operates out of there. And you may be told that the hospitals in the South that have Negro members on their staff, but they've probably picked out one Negro and given him staff privileges, which are restricted. And then the other Negro applicants turned down on the basis that they do not have certain qualifications. While at the same time, they're probably in any city, even of 100,000, there may be 25 doctors on that same staff that don't have qualifications any higher than the Negro doctors that they're turning down. They said, well, now our rules require that when we admit you to the staff, you've got to have so-and-so.
Could you make any observation about those doctors who take staff privileges under those circumstances, the Negro doctors who do?
Well, I've got mixed feelings about it. I'm not in the medical profession,
sure.
And beyond the observations I've made, I don't know whether I ought to go into that part of it.
You mean you could make some?
Probably could, yes. I'm not sure, though, that I have my mind made up on that.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
It is.
It's a tough one. Is it a disservice or a service, you might say, on the strict question of race, taking a matter of race pride and race advancing the actual relation between the white and the Negro race to a level of decency?
Well, there's one.
I don't know which way to play it. It might be a
well, there's one reason why a Negro doctor might want to do this.
I mean, aside from selfish reasons.
He might. Somebody's got to get in and see how it's done, so you can't give them the runaround anymore.
That's not a, this is selfish.
I mean, now that's on the on the positive side. This is not a selfish reason. This
no,
is
it's not.
And once he gets in, he's got to have the guts to make the demands and say to the other fellows, come on, I'll support you because I know what they're doing in terms of qualifications for other people who are no better than you are. If he's that kind of man, all right. If he's going to get in and thumb his nose at the rest, I wouldn't think well of it.
It's a delicate position for a man to be in, isn't it?
Not delicate if he's got his thinking straight.
Not many people have.
I admit that. It's sort of disappointing to find out how many people do not have.
No, I'm just thinking the ordinary situation.
For instance, I'm going to a dinner tonight involving the Democrats in the state, and they invited me.
Yes.
Well, I would not go unless they invited 8 other people. And told him I wouldn't be there. Now, I'm not so sure how it might be with some other people.
How is this now? You mean they were gone without stipulating this?
Yes.
It happened, yes, you said.
But it's a question of how straight your thinking is on a question like this.
And some people have easier consciences than others do, too.
Well, that's quite true.
More easily satisfied consciences, I mean. How do you... let me preface this remark, this question, by saying that among the people I've talked with, say, from the people that are at sort of top level of Negro organizations, you know, the big names, and on to kids of 21 or 2, there's a very great variety of ideas about what integration might mean, you see. Sometimes a very unclear version of how it may come about or what it would mean when it comes about, what it would actually be concretely, specifically. How do you think about that question? As some people say it's merely a word, you see. Some people have given a great deal of thought to it and have a very clear-cut version of what they mean by it.
Well, we've got a long way to go before a Negro boy or girl, a man or woman, has the same open invitation to industry and to industrial employment or to training or to promotion advantages that a white person would have. Now, this is what integration would mean to me, that the freedom of movement in society would be complete. We've been whacking away at the periphery of it.
You mean simply civil rights basis, you mean?
Yes. We've gotten the travel business straightened out some time ago, so far as public carriages were concerned, and then the dining cars and the sleeping cars and... Now the hotels and restaurants, this establishes the physical movement.
Yes.
But there's also got to be freedom of movement in all facets of the society. And this means if a man's good enough, he goes right on to the top. Without saying that this community is not ready now for a Negro to be chairman of the Housing Authority, which is what we had to happen here the other day. There's a Negro here who's been on the Housing Authority for about 15 years, and he's been the vice chairman. 3 different times, when the chairman resigned, they bypassed him. And he's got more experience in the housing field than all the rest of the commission put together. He's the treasurer of the insurance company here, in charge of their mortgage loans and all over the Eastern Seaboard. And this includes many multifamily projects, much more experience than anybody on the Housing Authority has, or anyone who's ever been on it has had. But someone leaked the word that the community just wasn't ready, and hoped everybody understood this. We had a Negro here who'd been here 17 years with a master's degree in recreation. And the recreation director resigned, and he was his assistant. And they brought a little boy out of Georgia, 23 years old, to take charge of the city's recreation program, and said to him, frankly, this has been within this year, that we hope you understand that the community isn't ready for, with all of your ability, isn't ready for a Negro to head the program. Well, the city manager decided this, and the city council's, with the city council's backing, but this is more or less the city manager's decision.
In other words, there's no way to know whether the community's ready or not.
Well, I'm just giving you the facts.
Yes, I mean, obviously, this excuse is always used, but take the theory that...
Well, they never will be ready if you're going to wait for everyone to agree. You just try to get someone who's competent, and no matter what the opposition, make sure that he's going to make the grade. This is what Jackie Robinson did, under tremendous pressure. But he had to be a whale of a ball player, or the whole idea would have been a flop.
Oh, sure.
But look at the people who were in his corner, like Ty Cobb, who at first just couldn't stand this. I mean, he said it just never would work. But before he died, he not only learned to know him, but to like him. We've got to make our beginnings in all these areas, and they're coming hard. They're not coming easily, and the roadblocks to Negro employment all over the South are terrific. The employment service, the U.S. Employment Service operated by the several states, is by design a complete block to entry into industry.
What about, have you read Whitney Young's recent book?
Just scanned it. I have a copy.
Well, his discussion of in quotes, preferential employment versus color counting, you know, that distinction. How do you feel about that?
Well, we've got some catching up to do. There's no question about that. We've got a lot of catching up to do. The state governments, and particularly the employment services, as I said, all through the state, through the South, are geared to do just the opposite.
Unpreferential.
Really, there's a movement which I think could be documented if we had to. To eliminate every Negro from the employment service in this state. There's too much going on there that Negro personnel shouldn't have a chance to know.
I can't ask this question. I was thinking about Whitney Young again. Let me tell you something else related to the future. Some sociological studies in the recent past have taken the line based on what's happened to other ethnic groups in America, Jews, Italians, and Poles, and Irish primarily, that as they have achieved more and more freedom of movement in society over the past, say, 25, 50, 75 years, the case may be, and have moved to the quote integrated status, where you find people of those that origin in all sorts of positions, including the presidential chair, the Supreme Court, and other places. The general tendency has been for those same groups to become tighter rather than looser, as they have the figures have shown that they have moved to their own center again at a certain time. This may not be even an important question, but it's an interesting one anyway to speculate about. And I've asked you many Negroes this question, and I don't always get the same answer. What would be your guess?
Well, I think we're going through uncertain phase of this. In which the tide doesn't run as strongly in that direction. But from where I sit, I see some very definite signs of cohesion on a stronger basis.
I was thinking of something
that we've had in the past, in the immediate past, I put it that way.
I wasn't thinking about solidarity in the sense of having a racial objective, you see, to win. I was thinking of assuming that you have...
You were speaking of a cultural solidarity.
Cultural solidarity.
Well,
or housing solidarity. I mean, moving back to the same locality, reassembling, as it were, by preference of being one's own ethnic group. This has happened, according to the surveys I've read today, with Italians, Jews, Irish, and Poles. You have a reassembling of the ethnic groups after some dispersion.
But I think it remains to be seen what's going to happen.
It clearly will remain to be seen.
Yeah.
We can't.
I don't think there's the same degree of solidarity, cultural cohesiveness that there was during Reconstruction.
You're referring to Negroes now?
Yes. We may have moved a little away, but... But to me, there are signs of some gelling of this now. We're in a phase of it in which the pendulum is swinging back the other way. Now, this doesn't have anything to do with concepts that individual Negroes have developed in much, much larger numbers than before concerning integrated housing. Integrated employment in many areas that were all white or all Negro. In other words, maybe we're not talking about the same thing, but...
There are several aspects of that. I was thinking the simplest one is where people live by choice. And if the society is free, so you can live where you want to, or buy property where you want to, and nobody's stopping it. No, either legally or otherwise, or by social pressures.
But there's got to be some freeing up of the housing market.
Oh, sure.
All the job...
There's no choice now.
All the job opportunities seem to lead back to housing position.
Well, I was taking a guess... After that happy day when there is mobility of movement, you see, mobility and choice.
Well, I think I'd rather wait and see what happens. The pressures are so strong now, and I don't mean pressures from people, but the pressures of our time and the circumstances. In terms of the urgency for moving into position for employment gains and other gains are so strong now that perhaps this doesn't have an opportunity for any free movement of his own, of its own.
Well,
I mean,
now,
a tendency of that kind.
Now several people... it's implied in Whitney Young's book, and it's spelled out by some other people, other Negroes and white people too, that the opening up of society for the Negro is not going to be accomplished without an overhaul of society. We are the words of a big social and economic overhaul, automation being the crisis that's going to precipitate this.
Well,
and this is what we're headed for.
Well,
a big economic and governmental.
I think you're right there. I was born in the South, lived there all my life, just about, and received my education in the South. But maybe I've been sort of foolish, but I've never felt that I was outside of the American society. I've always felt my freedom to go anywhere I wanted to go. Participate in anything that I had a desire to participate in. Now, I know this takes some... you got to develop some blind spots if you believe this, but the changes have been nothing new to me, I put it that way.
In what sense?
I've assumed all along that all of the people are alike, essentially. There's no basic difference between people because of race. If you can speak the same language, you're then completely on the same base. Maybe I've been naive, but and I fought pretty hard against injustices in the South all my life. There were things I just wouldn't do as a kid. Wouldn't give anyone a chance to Jim Crow me. And Martin Luther King's father and I were classmates in college. And one of the things about him was that he would never ride on a streetcar in Atlanta or a bus. I admit that I did, but he didn't. There were some other things that I wouldn't do. You just turned a blind side to participation in anything that didn't leave you standing up as a man.
That raises another question now.
And you do it without bitterness, and you assume that the people who are said not to like you are going to be all right when you approach them about something. And you do it on an eye-level basis.
The survey that Newsweek started, you know, a year or two, 2 years ago, I guess it was, Frank Hunter survey. One of the figures out of that was that in a slum and rural slum or city slum, among the ignorant and most oppressed brackets of Negroes, you had the most intense feeling that there is no good in the white man. You never, never, never be concerned about social problems involving the Negro. The higher you got in the scale of education and responsibility, more and more this changed. In the upper reaches, you have a fairly high percentage who would express some optimism, some confidence in ultimate decency or goodwill from white society.
Don't think it was real, though.
Hmm? You don't think it was real? You don't think it was, the interviewers were deceived? It couldn't be much difference.
I think you had more than my experience. And as a kid, I grew up in Atlanta. As a kid, the lower class white people and poor Negroes had some sort of common platform until the high ups stirred them up. And I've seen that happen here since I've been here. I've been here 35 years now. But
well,
I've seen that happen here. And the white population.
You're thinking then about the manipulation of race friction by some of the upper people up there.
Yeah, and those same people want to make sure. I know one man who gave a great big gift just to get on the board of trustees of a certain Negro college in the South, because he had to find out what those folks were doing. And the president of the school thought there was nobody like him. But his white friend, Dr. Will Alexander, you know, told me sitting on this porch over here one day about the story, about how he got on the board and how he went to that college president. And said, there's a man who doesn't talk very much, but he wants to do something for Negro education, and he's very farsighted. And I said, I want him to bring you on, you to think about bringing him on your board. And meantime, the gift was made. And the college president was so delighted. Now, that college president is still living, and he and I are very good friends. And I've told him about it, and he said, I'll be doggone. I said, you're just as right as you can be. He said, they tricked me in that. Mm-hmm. Said, I never knew it till now. So, but that's the way it happened. I told him the story of how the approach was made and all that. He said, well, that's exactly the way it happened. I said, I never had the least idea that that was the purpose of it.
Well, that's interesting. I'm glad you told me that anecdote.
It's and I know some others. I know two other Negro colleges in the South where the graduates have been rather militant. And the same thing happened in recent years.
That's not quite the question I originally put, though I'm glad we got this too.
Mm-hmm.
The question I originally put was this, that the more ignorant and oppressed Negroes find no possibility, a large percentage find no possibility, not in the white upper class or ruling group, but in white men at all, you see. They are more alienated, more totally alienated from the white man. And the higher you go in among the educated Negroes, and Negroes in responsible positions, or listen to leadership in general, the more confidence they have in the white society, recognizing the justice of their claim.
No, they've had to. They don't believe that by and large.
You mean that the Negro leadership doesn't believe that?
Hasn't. Since 1900, from about 1900 until, in the 30s, there was nothing, no relief available. If you resisted the system, there were no Supreme Court decisions. On practically every important matter that we think about today, in terms of freedom of movement and civil rights protection, was a closed door.
Oh, sure, that's true.
And the Negro leadership had to be very skillful. And it didn't dare express itself, except in rare instances. It played the white leadership for all it was worth. And being very careful and very skillful, knowing that they had no redress.
That same thing hold today?
To some extent, yes. But not nearly as much so.
To some extent,
clearly.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking, if you didn't believe that, though, that there is some possibility of an honest rapprochement with white society and recognition of the Negro's just claims, or the fact that his claims are just, put it that way, the Southern Regional Council would be a hollow mockery for you, wouldn't it?
Well, that's pretty good question to ask. And on this, I don't think I'd want to be quoted too much, but
you'll have a script.
Our white friends, who are really doing a creditable job now, many of them would not have been willing to identify themselves with the council 7 or 8 years ago.
Sure, things change.
I know some people who would be very helpful who said they thought they ought not to become members. I mean, they couldn't even become members of the council, and the council was not participating in any activity. It was just doing the mildest sort of persuasion. If that, they were doing most of the study.
Yes, it's educational.
We had an awful time keeping the racial balance in the council.
Are you getting enough white people?
Mm-hmm. Now that consciences have become aware, there have been changes in many of these people. In addition, the climate has made it easier.
It was a big change.
But there have been some fundamental changes in their thinking. It's not just that the climate is easier. And then all through this period, we've had a handful of people who were about whom there was never any question. And I could call their names. These were white people. But they were just a handful. And they were towers of strength in the kind of effort that we were putting on. They were not typical of the South. And when I say we had trouble just maintaining the racial balance in a group of less than 75 people, you can see how difficult the problem had become.
Now, here is some statements that are pretty current. It's one formulation is James Baldwin, not in the last book, but the one before that. He says that that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern people.
I agree with him. I remember hearing right after the Little Rock riots, the first ones, two Life magazine reporters talk about it around a luncheon table. And one of them said, "Before I knew it, I was chasing my buddy down the street as a part of the mob." Yes. In other words, there were two of them, and they smashed one of them's camera. The other one didn't have a camera. And then began to chase him. And the second one said, "Before I knew it." So to show you how terrifying a thing like this can be and how you can be caught up in the hysteria of a mob. So before I knew it, I was chasing him down the street. And finally I stopped and said, "What am I doing?"
Even hypnosis is just mob action.
That's yeah.
People in. Well, what about the people who are not there on the scene, who don't act, don't protest?
Climate hasn't been right.
I'm much struck with this in Mississippi. The number of people I know who are just... I mean, when I say sick in the heart or sick in the stomach, you see, who are isolated.
We've got to tip the scales in any community. The scales have to be tipped for it to be feasible. And you don't go around blaming these people. You work to try to get the climate just a little bit better so they'll have a chance to tip the scales on the positive side.
I was talking with Charles Ellis last spring on a couple of occasions. And he said he was fairly optimistic about southern Mississippi.
I think they've got to go through a number of stages.
And how far along are they now?
Well, this I don't know, but... One in which they feel they've accomplished a great deal. Or they've got to reach a certain plateau and then there'll be another one. And then another one. Even the most aggressive people will sort of be heaving a sigh of relief when they reach a certain stage. I mean, this is my impression.
And I'm human.
Then the pressures will bring them to start the next one. But the tempers may not be as great. It's been interesting in some of the things I've worked in to see how you work with the same group of people and you're at different ends of the table and you're fighting just as hard on both sides, but it gets to the point where you get used to each other and it doesn't have the tension that it had the first time you squared away.
Are you talking about people on opposite sides of the question or on the same, working together on the same
side? No, people on opposite sides. I mean, at first there's this tension. Yeah. And then you get to work at the problem that next time you meet, there's not as much tension. But you're not giving ground. Neither side's giving any easier, but it's still a struggle, but the tension lessens.
You mean some sort of a floating, you might say a floating aggression goes down.
Right.
Unfocused, sort of floating, vague aggression disappears, and the more and more they talk, they view their own on their own merits. Is that it?
That's right. But there's still a lot of determination on both sides.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't have the emotional pitch that it had in the beginning.
What do you think came out of the summer project in Mississippi? Do you have any views about that?
Oh, I think very lasting. It will have a very lasting effect, not only on Mississippi but the nation.
What about the effects in Mississippi? We know that the actual registration was low, but that could have been predicted, I should say.
Oh, yes.
But that wasn't the point. What about the effect on the sort of uncommitted white Mississippians? Sort of vague, you know, people have no basic feelings, they probably a faint preference for segregation or stronger, but not violent, not hardcore.
Well, I haven't spent the time in Mississippi. I just passed through it.
Mm-hmm.
I know a great many people from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And coupled with what they have to say and with the history of the state in the last 60 years, some of these people have memories that are long enough to put them back into another situation where the racial problem was not as tense and where Negroes held office.
You mean back to the late Reconstruction period?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that Reconstruction period ran for a long time because I can recall when I was in college in the 20s, Perry Howard was national committeeman for Mississippi, Republican Party. And then there was a collective customs in New Orleans. He was a Negro.
He was Roosevelt appointee. Teddy Roosevelt appointee, wasn't he?
Yeah. I don't know why I can't think of his name right now, but... the post... if you wanted to get a postmaster's ship, you had to see Perry Howard.
Mm-hmm.
And his name was very much revered in Mississippi. So there's some people who shouldn't have too much trouble adjusting, and then there were Negro businesses in every town, and very often I understand on the main street where they got the whole market. And by the way, and I can recall when I came to Durham that there were Negro merchants downtown, and they were frozen out, and no chance to get back. But there are memories in Mississippi that can actually go back to this when it was not a bad thing. Nobody was hurt by it.
Oh, sure, there's a synthetic element in the whole business that's been just created arbitrarily late time country, early post century. My grandfather talked about that. People of his generation, my father's generation,
sure.
Remember that world very well. You call.
Well, let's go to the corner.
All right. Let me ask Jada. How did you interpret the little split between, on one hand, Wilkins King and Young, and then Farmer and Lewis? On the other, on the moratorium proposal back just after the riots.
Well,
how did you interpret that?
I wasn't alarmed about it at all. Part of the growing pains of an operation.
Well, I'm more specifically than that. How did you think about it? Is this a matter of tactics on Farmer's part, do you think, or is it about?
I would think so.
Just keep control of the wild boys in the core. That's my guess, too, for a little while. Normal situation.
Yes, sir.